internet. I'm John, he's Mark, and welcome to the Enthusiasticast, where each episode we recommend an awesome book. This week, I'm going to be recommending William Gibson's new novel, Zero History, the third book in the so-called Big End trilogy, which also included Pattern Recognition and Spook Country. Now, this was a book that was on the radar for both Mark and myself since its announcement almost a year ago. It was the one shared pick on our top five most anticipated books of the fall lists, and it was a book that we were both going to go out and buy day and date, based solely on our enjoyment of Gibson's previous work. So before we get down to the nuts and bolts of the book itself, Mark, I wanted to ask you, are there any other authors that elicit the same kind of response in you, writers where you can't wait for a paperback or a library copy or a copy from a friend? Or is it more of a case-by-case basis, even with your favorites?
Dude, man, I don't know. Like, so this is a list of authors, day and date, you know, credit card on the counter the day it comes out. That list is short, you know.
Yep.
Five authors? No way. Like, there's one author that's on that list for me right now. And there may have been two. So I used to buy Paul Auster in hardcover fairly regularly after he pubbed. You know, I'd be around and pick his stuff up. But, you know, that was a thing from university. It was kind of the halo effect after reading the New York trilogy. I just kind of kept up with him and I kept buying him. But I don't do that anymore. And that's just kind of because of diminishing returns over time, I think.
Yep.
And so the you know, today, the one person that I reasonably keep up with in hardcover is David Mitchell. Now, since reading Number 9 Dream and, you know, in the early 2000s, I've kind of, you know, bought him at, you know, I bought the first Canadian print run of his hardcover stuff, right? So none of it, you know, his stuff since Number 9 Dream has been nothing like Number 9 Dream, and that's been fine with me. He's imaginative and inventive. And that would keep me coming back, you know, for you know, book 6 and book 7 of his. I don't know, call me disloyal, but I tend to be a little more fickle with people. And over time, I found that I, you know, will follow an author for a couple books, but then kind of drop out and be like, I'm moving on. So the William Gibson thing was purely based on Spook Country. I, you know, read early William Gibson a long time ago, and then basically missed the Bridge trilogy entirely, and then I didn't even read Pattern Recognition, actually. Read Spook Country, and because this is a quasi-sequel to Spook Country, I picked it up. But, you know, what about you? Like, are you more loyal than I am?
No. I was thinking about this list and trying to come up with this list of authors, I just realized, like, I am a shitty fan. Like, these people cannot count on me for their livelihood whatsoever because, you know, you're only as good as the last thing you did, right? There's authors that I've been with for, you know, that I've been reading for a long time on and off. And it started to look like I liked certain authors when they were doing a certain kind of thing. And then I realized that I punish other authors for doing the same kind of thing over and over and over and over again, right? So, you know, Nick Hornby is somebody who I've talked about on the show before. I'm a big fan of Hornby. I came in with like the 1-2 punch of About a Boy and High Fidelity and love those books. And based on the goodwill of those books, have been reading him ever since with diminishing returns. And I feel like now I'm going to be taking a wait and see with Nick Hornby, even though he's been doing the same kind of thing over and over again with, you know, minor variations. Somebody else like Guy Gabriel Kay is probably the closest I have to a day and date guy. I've been reading him for 20 years, and basically he comes out with a book and I buy it, and he, you know, he changes the setting, he changes the characters, but it's still historical fantasy. And so him I'm rewarding for doing the same kind of thing. And in fact, the one time that he went off book and he did it's like a book of poetry and songs, I have no interest in poetry and songs, so I haven't, that's the one thing of his that I haven't bought, that I haven't read. There's a few other guys who I would say right now they fall into that category of I buy them when they come out, but they're sort of, I think they're two bad books away from that not being the case. I'd say the first one is Mark Haddon, who wrote The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. I loved that book and bought his follow-up, A Spot of Bother, which I really enjoyed. It was it didn't get the critical love. It certainly didn't get the popular love that Curious Incident got, but I thought it was a really good book. I really enjoyed it, and I'm anxiously awaiting anything new in terms of adult fiction from him. He's written a lot of middle-grade fiction in the past, and they just re-released one of his books, and of course I'm not really interested in that. However, I'm totally not opposed to reading young adult fiction, and so there's a guy who writes young adult fiction, Louis Sachar, who wrote a book called Holes, which was turned into that movie with Shia LaBeouf, and that was young adult fiction, literary fiction, genre fiction, whatever. That was like a fantastic book, one of the best books I've read, and I loved that book. Totally didn't enjoy the follow-up to that, Small Steps. Didn't hate it, just didn't think that it was on the same level, but he recently pubbed a book called The Card Turner, which is about, of all things, bridge. It's literally about the game of bridge, and it should be the most boring book in the world, and it's not. It's a fantastic book. So he's a guy who currently I've always got time for, but if he, you know, a couple of duds, and I think I would probably, I'd probably let that slide. So
this kind of like totally blows up the thousand fan theory, right? Where it's just like, as publishing like kind of implodes, you can rely on your fans to give you $1,000 a year and you can remain, you know, a middle-class professional writer. And it's like, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, and I'm kind of, you know, a obsessive-compulsive pop culture nerd. But when I really examine the things that I will shell out for regardless of return, I don't know that there, I don't know that there's anything that, that can carry on that long. You get I would say two books with me, right? You know, one I'll just chalk it up to, hey, that wasn't for me. But by the second one, if it's not working for me, I'm gone. That's your window. And that's based on you doing something that I freaking love, right? That speaks to my soul and touches me in my heart. That's still only going to buy you two books out.
Man, I realized I was totally fickle because I was just like, if you become popular, like if I like you early and you become popular, that's actually more of a reason for me to abandon you than I was just like, oh, this is so bad to the world on the internet. But it's so, I was just like, yeah, I like because they're, you know, like my own little private discovery and I, you know, cultivate that or I cultivate the obsession from university or whatever. And it's like has nothing to do with like whether or not I enjoy it or whether or not they're, you know, doing quality work or whether it's like my relation to the literature in relation to society, which is like completely uneasy. It makes me uneasy admitting it, but that's
absolutely
the way it is.
That's an honest reaction. I was completely wrestling with that at the Scott Pilgrim 6 release party, where I was just like, does it make me a douchebag that I don't want there to be 1,000 people here? That I want there to be 12 people here? Back when, it, you know, like
Speaking
it was.
Speaking of Nick Hornby.
Oh, I know.
Okay, let's talk about Gibson, because I've actually read this book. So I, you know, like you, read early Gibson. I got turned on to Spook Country. I really enjoyed it. You were meh, and I was just like, no. It's worth your time. I really liked it. You picked up Spook Country, and then we both. It was like the Mutual Appreciation Society. We both got excited about Zero History is Newest, and you're obviously endorsing it today. Yep. But I've read it as well, so. That's unusual in kind of the enthusiastic cast canon. What is your tee off point for this?
Well, I think I was really struggling with how to present this as something that I was enthusiastic about, because although I think that you can read Zero History as a standalone novel, I think for me it really benefits from having read actually both Pattern Recognition and Spook Country. In the sense that I think it's the strongest of the three. So part of my appreciation for Zero History comes from how I was trained to expect certain things by the previous two novels, and how it, you know, in certain ways it plays into those expectations, and in certain ways it plays counter to those expectations in a really pleasant way. But at the same time, I kind of feel like if you've read Pattern Recognition and Spook Country, then you don't need me to recommend this book to you. You're either in or you're out, right? You know what the score is, and so this recommendation is kind of moot. And at the same time, like you said, I read Pattern Recognition, and nothing about that teed me off to go into Spook Country. I gave Spook Country a pass when it first came out, not because I hated Pattern Recognition, but I just didn't find it super compelling, largely because I felt it failed on a plot level, and I wasn't appreciating the other things that it had going for it beyond the plot, or it led me to expect that it was going to have a more traditional thriller plot based on the MacGuffin, the setup of the MacGuffin in that story, and the sort of globe-trotting espionage arc of it. And then I felt it really didn't deliver on that. And so then you read Spook Country, you enjoyed that. So I went into Spook Country. And so the fact that Spook Country, you spend most of the book going, how do these people connect and where is this going? I was okay with that because I had the experience of Pattern Recognition. So in my mind, as I was reading Spook Country, I was like, you know what? This might not go anywhere. I'm really just along for the ride. It's more enjoying how this novel is looking at the world, the particular lens that it's applying to post 9/11 America, and the notion that we are living in, that we're living in a science fiction society, right? That science fiction is happening all around us, and more this idea of the Arthur C. Clarke, I don't know if you call it an aphorism, but he was the guy who said to any sufficiently advanced science will appear as magic to a more primitive society. And so we kind of have that going on in our society, and I think that that's what Spook Country and again Zero History illustrates, that not only the striations or the stratification between rich and poor has increased to such a huge level where we're almost in Victorian times, but also the stratification between high tech and low tech has increased to such a point that right now you can walk out into the world and you can find things which are real, which are not future technology, but they're so far advanced to what you know that they appear to be science fiction. So that you, every one of us is to a certain extent living in a science fictional universe. And so I really enjoyed that about Spook Country, went along for the ride, and then Zero History came along. And so you get a lot of the characters. I don't want to say which characters, because if you're going to read Spook Country first, you know, it sort of reveals their fate if I say who reappears in Zero History. But the characters are the same. So there's that comfortable feeling of these are people that I know and like, and I feel like they got better character arcs in Zero History, almost Shakespearean in a lot of ways, not in the tragic sense, but more in the almost like a Shakespearean comedy. And also it had a better thriller plot. It had the best thriller plot of the three books. I felt it built tension better, and it paid off tension better than any of the previous books. So just on a pure plot and character level, it was absolutely a better structured novel and a more enjoyable read. And it just developed and deepened those themes from the earlier books in really interesting ways. The more I think about it, some of the observations that it's making kind of make me uncomfortable, but that's a good thing too, that it's got that depth of field. What about you? What did you think of it?
I think I disagree, actually. I think
all right.
Yeah. So, not that I hated it, but I'm on the fence. You know, near the end, so Spook Country features Hollis Henry and a character named Milgram.
Right.
And I think that that's not spoiling that they both reappear, because that's actually on the promotional material, right? So near the end of Zero Hystery, you know, Milgram asks about his medication, and they're like, dude, you've been on placebos for the last 3 months. And he's just like, oh, well, I like placebos. Right? Do you remember? I don't know if you got that far, but this book is a big placebo. And after reading it, I'm just like, you know what? I like placebos. So you and I have talked about how Gibson is kind of like Gaiman. He just can't finish.
Right.
And I forgive Gibson for that more than I do Neil. And because it's kind of, like, that's kind of the point, right? Like, that's kind of what Gibson does. Like, he's not Michael Bay, right? Like, you're not. And if he added, like, lots of crazy explosions and lots of bling to his plots, that'd just be weird. So going into this, I was kind of resigned to like it, because it's, you know, what Gibson's good at, you know, the perception, the futurism around perception and aesthetics, and, you know, and there's tons of that, you know, like the moods, the ideas. He's evocative of, you know, just kind of future present, you know, and the ugliest t-shirt in the world. Like, I love that idea. I was just like, what? And then I was like, oh, this is cool. And there's a concept that he talks about, the aggregate order flow.
Yes.
And I was just like, you know, that is awesome. It's MacGuffin, just like the shipping container in Spook Country. But unlike Spook Country, there's no conflict here. You know, and in terms of thriller plots, I don't think I agree with you. You know, like, there's
really you thought that this had a less good thriller plot than Spook Country.
I did, yes. And so you've got, like, in Spook Country, you've got, like, Brown and Milgram, right? And in this book, you've got, like, Milgram and Winnie. And, you know, no, I get the compare and contrast. And having read both novels, I'm just, like, nodding along. But in terms of conflict, there's no conflict there. In terms of suspense, there's no real suspense in the kind of two main plot arcs I found. I wasn't chomping at the bit going like, oh, there's real the mystery of the designer denim didn't really propel the plot, nor did the mystery of the, you know, aggregate order flow. Like, that's, they're both kind of throwaways. No?
I guess so, but I feel like with the introduction of the paramilitary guys, it added a level of real threat for the characters. Whereas in Spook Country, there's no conflict whatsoever, or the conflict is very easily resolved. There's a lot of tension about whether or not, you know, Brown and Milgram are going to be able to get on to this other group of people, but then they never do. There's one moment where they go with the one guy with the car, which he easily evades, and then from that point on, it's gravy. It's like, yes, our super plan, our exploit that we plan to pull off, and okay, now I'm spoiling, but I have to make the case. Just sort of goes off without a hitch. All that stuff that we wanted to do, yeah, we did it. It went exactly the way we planned that it was going to go, and it kind of happened. And whereas in this one, there's this genuine sense that, you know, towards the end of the novel, where you know, the conflict really ramps up, there's this genuine sense that, you know what, this can go pear-shaped, and there's genuine stakes. I thought one of the my favorite parts of the novel was when Big End reveals that he's willing to give up Milgram, right? I thought that was really revealing of character, and I thought it played into the larger themes of what Big End represents, in terms of wealth and in terms of sort of the monolithic forces of culture. And at the same time, you're like, I like Milgram. I don't want anything bad to happen to him. And there's a sense that although there's a sense that bad things can happen to the characters in this novel for me in a way that there wasn't in the other books.
Interesting. Because I was also really compelled with like the whole Tito subplot of Spook Country, and like,
I thought Tito was awesome. But
who are these guys, and what are they about, and what are they doing, and like where's this going, and stuff like that. Anyway,
but that never really like Tito was. I was kind of hoping Tito would make a return appearance in this book because I liked the way some of the characters in this book, some of the characters who reappeared from Spook Country, the way they interacted, sort of deepened my understanding of all of the characters. It was in the same way that you have characters in this book who will come into a space that another character has already been in and experience it from a different way. They've got Hollis has the room at the private club. And I think at least three characters. So you get, first of all, you get her impressions of that room early on in the book. And then I think at least three other characters come in and see that room and comment on it, and they all appreciate it in different ways. And I feel like that was happening with the characters as well. As you have characters from different books and different storylines bumping into one another, you're getting different perspectives on the same people, which I really liked.
Yeah, and you know, I already copped to having not read Pattern Recognition.
Right. So there's a character at the end of this novel who is from Pattern Recognition. And that wouldn't have resonated for you, obviously, because you haven't read it.
Right. Yeah. So my sense is that kind of Gibson is getting high in his own supply here to a certain degree. Like, Gibson does subculture and kind of edge case really well. Yep. And you know, if you start with that premise, the one fringe subculture that he kind of fetishizes in this book are the reoccurring characters from previously in the trilogy. You know, you spend a lot of time with characters that, you know, if you were picking up Zero History cold, it would be like, what? You know? So like, when Hollis does her final interview, and I'm sure a lot of people like that's chapter whatever, like 69 or whatever, I'm sure a lot of people that have read the previous trilogy were like, oh my god, like, oh, and I wasn't one of those people.
Right.
And I wanted more payoff, and, you know, the stuff with the paramilitary guys, like, sure, but he takes you as one kind of just inert example, the band member, Heidi, right. The band member is introduced.
Yeah. And, Heidi, the drummer from the Curfew.
Yeah. And so you go, you follow kind of like a side arc with her for a little while. And that I'm sure like, it's not quite fan service, but it's like,
she's kind of a fan service-y character.
But it's not because he still uses that character in that side arc to you know, do what Gibson does best, which is kind of aesthetic fetishism, right? Like you're like, oh yeah, cool. But at no point does that build suspense or build conflict or whatever. Like you enjoy spending time with her and you enjoy spending time with her story, but it doesn't service the overall tension in the book, I found.
True. I think I feel like he latched onto something with Spook Country, with the band and music subculture. And I feel like that was a great access point for talking about what we were talking about earlier, about the tension and the conflict between art and commerce, between doing exactly what you want and being popular. Like for me, coming out of this, I feel like the biggest discussion was about selling out. And ultimately, I feel it comes down to if you're any good at what you do, you're selling out is something that's going to happen. And it's the best you can hope for is to sell out on your own terms, or, you know, sell out in a way that's most beneficial for who you are and what you do. And so, you know, Heidi was examining an aspect of that, right? Because Heidi, you know, tried to sell out in a specific way by getting married and moving to Hollywood, and it didn't really work out for you, for her. And then, you know, Inchmail. So Inchmail is selling out in his own way. He's becoming the man behind the process, and that seems to be working out a lot better for him, partly because he's paired with a marketing person. His wife, who we never meet, is a kind of junior big end, right? And so she's got the skill set that allows him to make that work for him. And then Hollis is flailing about, and that comes into stark relief with the character behind the Gabriel Hounds brand. And so I just feel like Heidi was a different way of exploring that side of things. Milgram is a way of exploring, you know, post 9/11 paranoia and, you know, ideas of privacy and surveillance and self-creation. But it really worked for me. I really, really, really dug it.
That's I'm not going to argue say. With
I
know, you.
The more I talk, the more I'm giving away and spoiling. So I'm just going to come down on it worked for me.
Okay, so just one quick comment. Like, every time I read one, like a Gibson book, it feels like there's a pivot point in my head of just kind of like point of view. I don't know if that makes sense. The whole locket of art thing, the whole location-based art thing in Spook Country, I thought that was awesome, right? And that, you know, I had a long conversation with a guy from the art college here in town about that. It totally blew my mind when I read it at the time. And now, of course, augmented reality is on every iPhone. And he mentions that in the book, and it's totally true, right? And so that whatever that is, like 3 years, you go from what was edgy and wild to now kind of like iPhone mundane. And, you know, Gibson has this line. He's just like, yeah, no, I do futurism, but it's like futurism from last Tuesday.
Right.
And that's like so on the nose. So going from Spook Country to now is really like that. And I experienced, and, you know, normally I've read Gibson either out of time or, you know, not as those things have happened. You know, I guess the internet has happened and all cyberspace and the whole thing. But to watch that happen in such a compressed time, to see Locket of Art become augmented reality, you know, in the space of real time following the two books, I was just like, that sensation is just really neat. And more than the story itself, that ability to kind of like read in the future is something that's going to keep me coming back to Gibson for the next time, even though I was kind of overwhelmed with the mystery of the whole thing.
Well, it's interesting that in Spook Country, there are no iPhones and there's no Twitter. And yet 3 years later in Zero History, it's all iPhones and Twitter. Like, that's actual social tech, which didn't exist, you know, was created, became mainstream, and has been completely integrated in the space of 3 years. So you can see how he's always said that science fiction, as you're writing it, acquires kind of a patina of the quaint and the outdated, because you can only write about the future from the point of the present, and the further that you get from that point, the more it doesn't seem to be effective anymore. The more, you know, the less accurate you're becoming, and the less accurate your comments are becoming, and that is accelerated to such a rate that it seems like his response is the only sane response, right? Which is to write about a version of the present as much on the edge as you can and just hope that you can capture a moment in which those comments and those thoughts are relevant, because the future is just speeding forward at such an insanely accelerated rate that you're just making a time capsule even as you're writing.
You know, aside from disagreeing with you and saying like, oh, you know, the payoff wasn't really great. I was just like, Gibson, man, you still have it, dude. Like, that is still awesome. And I will still give you money the next time for that experience, because that is good stuff.
It is.
Yeah,
it is. Okay.
Do you want to end it there then?
Let's do it.
Okay, before we end up spoiling the whole thing. Because I'm also like, we should probably...
Big End is a sled.
We should probably have a conversation about pattern recognition at some point, but let's do that offline. So let's end it there. Thanks so much for listening. For more exciting and enthusiastic reviews, check us out on iTunes. We also have a blog at enthusiasticast.com. Look there for random musings and more enthusiasm. You can send us an email at hello@enthusiasticast.com. Until next time, I'm Mark. Be generous with your enthusiasm.